I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, Jason Klom here with the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. No particular year, no particular album. We're going to be talking about is not entirely. It's going to be comedy album adjacent. This week, we're discussing Vaughn Meter with the delightful Sheila Meter Stratton, and you were Vaughn Meter's wife, or he was your husband. I don't mean to diminish you. You, the two of you.
Well, you know, it was four. He was husband number three, and I was wife number three.
Okay, all right. So that's the you guys settled on a good third time's a charm. That's not bad.
Absolutely.
So let's get right into it. People, if they've heard my podcast before, hopefully they have heard the episode we did on the first family, which we're going to get into how that was. That's just the tip of the iceberg with the stuff he did creatively. People who know his story, I think there's one of the big misconceptions is that, oh, this guy tried to have a career, he had a career, and then his career and life ended because John F. Kennedy was dead. And that's really how the picture gets painted in popular culture. There's so much more to him, not only when he tried to have a comedy comeback, but also when he settled into a relatively real life compared to how many creative people live their lives and still continued on being creative.
You know, he always wanted to be a stand-up comedian, piano player, entertainer. He had no intention of ever following up on the first family, but he had contractual agreements that insisted that he do the first family volume 2 and then whatever happened to Vaughn Meter and have some nuts and on and on.
You see, I had wondered that myself. I own volume 2. I've only listened to just a little bit, and I do still really enjoy the first family an album. I've talked about this a little bit before on the podcast. I have this weird obsession with buying as many copies as I can. I think it's because of this ubiquity, and there's part of me that's like, I don't know, you know, it was ubiquitous, and then all of a sudden you get this feeling that people were just offloading them because they're just so sad. But, you know, they are also clearly in these people's houses here, because where I live in Burbank, California, everybody's of a certain age. The people whose estate sales I'm going to shop at are of a certain age. They all had it. You know they had the album. Everyone had the album.
You know, the loveliest thing is whenever anyone found him and sent him an album cover, he would sign it. He did this for years and years. And after he died, I would come across someone who would hold it up and say, oh, look, I have the first family album. And
yeah.
I say, well, yes, let me have it. He'll sign it. And, you know, it took me a while to register he wasn't going to sign it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. It's so nice that, see, and then there we go. Right there is an example that obviously that wasn't just like some giant bitter pill for him. He must have still had some joy in people remembering who he was.
Oh, always. Oh, gosh, yes. He was the consummate, remember who I am and let's move on here to something more exciting.
It's nice to hear because, like I say, the story in popular culture just stops at a certain point. But he did do, he did try and do a lot of comedy albums. Were any of them after that contractual obligation of his own design? I had a feeling maybe The Second Coming was his, but I rather get the perspective from you.
Yes. The Second Coming was very his. And it was well reviewed by a few people who were interested in listening. The problem is, shortly after Kennedy died, people stopped listening. Mm-hmm. People didn't sit. Didn't come together with, covered casseroles and sit down and listen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So the need for, the first family, that sort of thing, went away. So by the time The Second Coming appeared, it was meant to be said and listened to. And Abbott really didn't get that.
Yeah. Do you have a concept of what changed culturally that made that no longer seemingly necessary for families to get together and do that?
Oh, well, television was just full of excitement. I think we were We were working on cell phones at that time so we could be unattached and move around. You know, those great big clunky things that look like bricks. Things move fast. It's, you know, acceleration. Everything started moving faster, and it's going faster yet.
You've got me, obviously my brain is going all over the place in terms of trying to think, you've got a point that was at a time where there's a certain type of record also about to come out. Like, for instance, I'm friends with the gentleman from the Firesign Theater. That's a very different type of album. And what he was doing with the Second Coming is very much, there's a bit of music in it. But there's also, you know, it's sketch. It's also one long story, one sketch about Jesus literally coming back and basically hanging out with the hippies, but in a different way.
Well, yes, and I liked Abbott's version of, Christ coming to Manhattan in a rainstorm and getting a cab, and everyone thinking, it's a miracle. He must be something very special if he can do that. So I think Abbott tended to follow trends, and he was always a little bit behind the trend line. He was still making 45s when those records were gone, when, you know, tapes were the thing at the moment, and then, CDs and on. So he really didn't, I don't know, I think he was so happy with the way things were that he didn't look forward. He looked at, not forward.
Well, and I mean, that's it's a thing I think of artists, especially if they hit a moment where, you know, and people treat this as a sadder thing than I think it really is. It's just like it is what you understand, and if what you understand worked once, it becomes hard to kind of let that go.
It's true. But that didn't stop Abbott, actually, because he wanted, what he really wanted to do was write music, find someone who would back him, you know, in making a record.
Sure.
And then he was done with it. I watched that happen several times, that the people who invested money were always so disappointed, because after it was done, after it was printed, then Abbott just shrugged his shoulders and did nothing, and people were expecting at least to make their money back, not
right.
to become famous producers in the process, and it never happened.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That's so interesting. I mean, you know, again, as a creative myself and as a creative who likes to do a bunch of things, like it's interesting to hear some parallels with, you know, you just want to get the thing done, get it finished, and then you always sort of hope that there's going to be someone that's going to run with it for you, and you just don't have to think about it anymore.
Well, and he wouldn't. That's the thing. He wouldn't let anyone else either. And that was frustrated me, because I'm a, you know, someone who goes out and does that kind of, contacts people and says, you know, let's hear this. But no, it had to be totally done. He was off to the next adventure.
Right.
He was a child. He had ADHD. What is it? ADHD? He
had, oh, really?
Whatever,
okay.
It is. And what no one really knew, I think, is that beyond that bipolar issue, he was brilliant, and he was, I think, suffocated in not being able to find the people to manage him. He needed managing. At the same time, he refused to be managed. So he never found the strong person who could help him with that. Wait. But he wrote some really great songs. You know, the thing is about Abbott is he finally, after he and I got together, after he and his third wife were done, and I came on the scene, he mellowed out a little bit, and he wrote some fun music at that time. And he wrote, I found it, as a matter of fact. We had talked earlier about what I call CB Santa, but what I found out he called Breaker Breaker Ho Ho Ho. So he wasn't calling it CB Santa. But I found a copy of that. I played it this morning. And White Christmas, Sasa Clement was on it, Doug Dillard, John Hartford, Abbott, of course, at the piano and vocal. And it's a great little song, you know. And I keep thinking, now, how would I go about making this yet another novelty Christmas song? but it may be too late. Who does CDs?
Right. Well, I will tell you this, at least because my friend Dan and I, who have been doing sketch comedy together since we were very tiny, we became obsessed about a year and a half ago when we found a song called, like I said, called CB Santa. I had assumed, oh my goodness, did Von Meter secretly create it? No, apparently he also did it. But we became so obsessed that last year or the year before, we decided to do our own CB song, which of course, yes, entirely out of time. Why would anybody do it now? But you know what?
Yeah.
Truckers still use them. So, I mean, it's a fun experience. So I will say, and I'm not holding you to anything, but I would love to hear that.
I'll play it for you right now if you want to.
Of course. Yes, let's do it.
Really?
Yeah, if you want.
Well, I happen to have it. Let me turn on. The first, you're going to get side two first. You're going to get them playing. Oh, no. Oh, White Christmas. Yeah, hold on.
Yeah, the worst trip I've had was in Kentucky with a windstorm. In fact, the wind was blowing so hard, I saw a duck flying backwards, laid the same egg three times. Well, the worst trip I ever had was a few years ago, the night before Christmas. Made a turnaround in Beantown with lumber on my rig. Tried to make it home by dawn, the storm was brewing big. Fluff stuff was everywhere, but I kept trucking on. 'Cause I had promised Ruth and the kids I'd be home by Christmas morn. Well, the pike was like the ballroom floor, all slicked up for the dance. Every mile I traveled down, I was taking one big chance. Well, I held on the wheel with all my might, and I prayed at every turn. When all of a sudden on the old CB came the strangest sound I've heard. The trigger breaker, ho, 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 came a voice on 23. I'll guide you home through all the snow, just leave it all to me. Well, he showed me where the Smokies were, told me the best highway. And as I kept my eye for spying the sky, I swear I saw the sleigh. Well, I thought I was seeing things, a gone stark raving mad. But in my mind, getting home on time was the only thought I had. Now I've been trucking since 36, and I've seen some hairy drives. But deep down under, I began to wonder if I'd ever get home alive. I knew the kids would be waking up to decorate the tree. We always do that every year, Ruth, the boys and me. So I kept concentrating on the work I had at hand. And after a while, I had to smile. He came back on the citizen's stand and said, breaker, breaker, ho, ho, ho. He called in one more time. You've only 50 miles to go. You're gonna make it fine. So the storm is letting up ahead. He jabbered loud and clear. And as I kept my eyes for a sign in the sky, I swear I saw reindeer. Well, you might think I'm crazy, but I kept that TV on. Now and again, he came in again. It was like a Christmas song. Then my worries fell behind me, and my troubles disappeared. Yeah, I tell you, boys, that stranger's voice was music to my ears. And when my trip was finally over, and I came through my front door, well, Ruth, the kids, the Christmas tree never looked so good before. Had a cup of mud and mincemeat pie that Ruth had baked for me. But wouldn't you know, my friend on the road came back on a house TV. Said, breaker, breaker, it's good to see you home. Now I got some toys for girls and boys, and I gotta travel on. And as I glanced out of my window, he traveled out of sight. Merry Christmas to all, 10-4, he called. All good buddies, good night.
Well, that's our version of it.
I love it. I love it so much.
I do too.
What year was that? I'm assuming he's got a year on it.
Oh my God, it was before me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well,
it had to have been, oh gosh, I'm trying to think. It had to have been in the early 80s or late 70s. I don't know. So many of the players who are on that are dead now. Doug Dillard is dead. I don't know about Bassa Clements. Abbott's dead. John Hartford is dead. John Hartford and Abbott. That only leaves Bassa if he's still alive.
I do know that he, well, I say no. You know, you read these things online, you hope the information's correct. He did play bluegrass, correct? That was a thing that he did.
Yes. Abbott loved bluegrass.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this crew did. Dillard and Hartford and Vassa, great fiddler. Oh, gosh, yes. That's the kind of music they liked and played.
That's great. And I love that he got to put his own little twist on it. And I'm assuming that's him singing.
Yeah, it's great.
Great voice. His voice is so different in so many things that I've listened to and watched. I was watching one of the 60s game shows that he, you know, was probably contractually obligated to be on, where he was just so quiet, just in talking to people. It obviously turned it on when he was playing Kennedy, but was he that quiet in conversation? Was he very quiet, mild-mannered? I'm curious.
Oh, gosh. Well, it depended on the season of the year. If it was coming up on Christmas, it was eggnog and not necessarily quiet. Let's see. It would be Mount Gay and Coke during the hot months, and that wasn't particularly quiet. He was very well balanced in understanding the people he was with and talking with. When he did What's My Line? You know, Kitty Carlisle practically fell over the table to hug him or congratulate him. He really appealed to people. He had a lovely way about him, and he was a people person. He wanted someone with him all the time, or to be with someone all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily to pay any attention to that person, but that person was always... There is his, I don't, strong, that's the role I played. I was the strong backup behind him. He knew if he stepped back or reached back, I'd be there so he could go ahead and do what he needed to do.
When did the two of you meet?
We met in 1982, I think.
Okay.
Because... it was at a piano bar in Rockwood, Maine.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, he had settled into life in Maine.
Kind of. He never settled into anything. Yeah. Well, he was there because there was no other place. He always was next to being homeless and just found another place every time.
Was he just a traveling artist? What was the reason for that?
No. He wasn't like Pine Top or any of those people who just traveled.
Mm-hmm.
He traveled because he would soil his nest and have to go find a new nest wherever it was. He was with Margaret St. James, the head of the Hookers Union in L.A., in San Francisco, in Mill Valley. And I'm trying to think of where... Of what other places? Before that, he burned through three wives pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just made up my mind that I was not going to be burned through, that I was here for the duration, and I was.
Yeah.
So it was a long, 20 years that we were together.
But you
do know about his other fun songs, don't you? The work song, I don't like to work, I like to play. My wife gets on my case most every day.
I don't think I know that. This is the problem. Oh. If you go online and go on into certain resources, if you pick the wrong one, the discography for him is limited. It only shows Have Some Nuts, this one, Volume 2. Very few. So
yeah.
Where
because
would I have found
were
those?
All these... Jason, these were all made by the largesse of people he talked into, paying for studio time.
Uh-huh.
And they're great. They're fun. I'll tell you who probably has most of the masters is Scott Perot, who lives in Reedfield, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
He probably has the masters for the work song, for Rise in Love, which everyone, when he does this to an audience who knows him, they laugh and they're ready for the Viagra song. And when the Rise in Love comes up, everybody jumps up and puts up their eyes. It's really the Viagra song is fun. He wrote that and the work song. With every wife, at some point when he became unhappy or disillusioned or ready to move on or just miserable, he would write a song.
Yeah.
And he wrote Rise in Love and Work Song, and it seems like there was another one on my watch that I can't remember now which one it was, but they were all fun. Just pleased audiences because they were clever.
Right,
I guess is the word for it.
So when you found him, and it sounds like you did find him.
Kind of.
I'm just curious how you met. Again, you're being frank about it. I'm curious what condition you found him in and how you kept him going, because it's not easy with an artist who, I don't know if he was troubled. There are things online say he was a recovering alcoholic, this and that. I don't know how much I can trust.
He never recovered.
Yeah.
Never recovered from any of those things that he did. He blew his face up once.
Oh, my God.
Because he had serious COPD, and he had a floor accumulator, but he had not gotten to the point yet where he realized that he couldn't smoke anytime he wanted to, so he had his oxygen going up his nose and lit a cigarette.
Oh.
Boom.
Oh.
That was unnerving. That was really the beginning of the end. He didn't live more than 6 months after that.
Mm-hmm.
But he also does another song. There are two other pieces of music, Jason, and
mm-hmm.
while I have your attention,
mm-hmm.
one of them I can't find. It was it was before Kennedy died. It was to go out in November. It was to go out for Christmas. It was headed to go out in November. 200 copies, I think, had been sent out to DJs of the president telling Caroline the night before Christmas, when all through the White House, nothing was stirring, not even a security guard. And he told that to me, a couple of Christmas, just a nostalgia thing. And he had this most beautiful, melodic, the most beautiful voice of any man I have ever heard talk, quite frankly, except maybe never mind. Just the way he said those few lines each time, it was like warm water, a warm oil. It felt so cozy, and you just knew you were Caroline sitting on Daddy's knee, and he was telling you this story. And I'm guessing that when the president was killed in November, that the package, the boxed up records ready to go out for Christmas sales, were either destroyed or, you know, hid deep in who knows what kind of storage place. I can't find one, and I'm desperate to have it.
Oh, now, but you've heard it, it sounds like.
No,
oh,
okay. I've only
so
heard Abbott.
He just performed it for you. I see.
A little bit, yeah.
So it's interesting. Like, the assumption is, and again, this is how pop culture goes, the assumption is, well, that killed his career, and he stopped having any interest in it. But so he was willing, because he cared for you. He was still willing to, like, sure, I'll do my Kennedy. Like, that was just the thing
he
would do.
No, he never did it for me. He did it for himself.
Okay.
I was there. I was the audience. He always had to have an audience.
Okay.
And it was just a little kick of nostalgia at the moment, and he would do that. I don't think anyone else but me ever heard him do it,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just. Oh, you have no idea how I long. And that was on Verve, I think. I have this here somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he did Johnny Sunday, and that was his with his wife before me.
Mm-hmm.
That cost a fortune and went nowhere. As a matter of fact, I find it a bit of an embarrassment.
But, really?
And then we eventually moved to Gulfport, Florida, and Tom Hanks's company, which was then called Clavius Bass, found him.
Uh-huh.
And got he had a contract signed for exclusive rights to Abbott's life story,
mm-hmm.
which has been written and rewritten, or scripts, the work, whatever it's called, the
mm-hmm.
scripts have been done twice. A young fellow who's a writer named Alex Wu came all the way
mm-hmm.
to Augusta to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, there was interest there for years and years afterwards. But what I would like, because Abbott, when he was done with the first family, he never wanted to do it again. He
mm-hmm.
was so over it. He wanted to write his own music. He was a great lyricist for fun music, and that's what he wanted to do. And he, of course, he kept sabotaging every time he got it done. But
yeah,
like John Brown, for instance, up at Moosehead Lake, had a restaurant called the Cabbage Patch. And at that time, Greenville and the area was having a terrible problem with their sewage abatement system. And some of the town fathers decided that what they needed was a little publicity. So Abbott wrote this absolutely delightful, fun, pointed. He was very, very bright. His music was always pointed. Song for the publicity. Let's get a new. Let's spend some, you know, federal and state and local money and be able to flush our toilets.
Mm-hmm.
It was just plain fun. God, that's what he really should have been doing with his life.
Yeah. What? Well, let's get some perspective from you, because we can compare what the truth is to what the story is. And, you know, there was a, he did an interview with, I think, I want to say it was, let me pull it up here. I want to say it was either the Times or the Washington Post. There was an interview he did that was him being apparently very frank about, you know, it was with the Washington Post. And this is in, you know, this is in 79. So this is, you know, he was still relatively young.
Yeah.
And just talking about, you know, drugs and running naked through the streets and all these things.
Oh, yeah.
He's very frank in these interviews. And so, and I think that's where a lot of the, you know, conjecture comes from when people read these things. They're like, they hear one thing that sounds crazy or, you know, that sounds, you know, really super interesting, and they'll just go off on that. And then mm-hmm. that was the rest of his life. I'm curious mm-hmm. Who was the guy when you met him? What of his life did you know? What of his life did he tell you? And again, this is your personal life. You don't have to tell me any of this, but I'm curious.
Well, I guess I'm going to have to confess. My children know and my family knows, but I really somehow bought the 80s culture, the runaway mother thing, and that's what I did. I had two teenage sons and a dog and a husband and a home, and I fled,
mm-hmm.
and I fled to Moosehead Lake, where I got a job cooking. And I, at that time, I was addicted to, I guess I've got to be frank, not only alcohol, but sex and Escitrol, which is speed. And I thought, this is a horrible way to live, and I have to stop. So
mm-hmm.
I went to the North Woods. I thought, where else am I going to be able to do this, you know, get okay again with the North Woods? So I was living at this lodge where I was cooking, and my room was upstairs over the kitchen, and for 3 weeks I was so good. I suffered, but I was so good. And finally, I went to the store one day, and there was a brochure in the window, and there was Von Meter at the piano bar at the inn, the Rockwood Inn, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. So I thought, I got to do it. I have to go out or I will go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So piano bar came in. The doors to the piano lounge were at the foot of the piano, not up at the keyboard. So there were a lot of locals sitting around because they loved him. You know, he just entertained them endlessly with stories and songs that he made up on the spot. And he was a star there. And I came in and I sat down and I ordered a martini. Stupid. So by my third martini, I was up at the end of the keyboard. And I said, if I can go home with you, I'll have a shower and be gone before you wake up in the morning. And he said, I don't have a shower. And I never left. That was it.
Yeah.
I know without even giving it another thought that I was brainwashed. The first thing he did was load me with alcohol and marijuana and hash, of all things. I was sick for 3 days, and I kept hearing his voice. Yeah, I kept hearing his voice through this haze of misery saying, you will never get drunk again. You will never drink again. And I didn't, and I don't.
Wow.
But that was the very beginning of this brainwashing thing that I went through. And I was his devoted ghost for the longest time. You know, I bought the vehicles, which I was never allowed to drive, paid for this and that, which I got very little from for myself, because he was magnificent. He was the star, and he decided that we were going to go to California. And I didn't want to go to California, but I found myself buying a van, and he took me on the trail that he had taken every one of his wives on. It seems that that was one of the things he did, was to introduce each of his wives to the same experience.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, none of them reacted the way I did. My reaction was to say, oh, the poor thing needs me, rather than, I've scored a famous man, now I'm going to be famous too. You know, I couldn't.
Right.
At that point, he didn't seem like a famous man. He just seemed like someone who needed nurturing and taking care of.
Sure.
So I did.
Wow.
So we went to the West Coast. We stayed with Margo St. James in Mill Valley up on Da Silva Island, which was an amazing thing. He and Margo had an affair for a while, but she moved on, and he just knew all these amazing, famous people. Joel, whose last name I don't remember, was the man who first held the handheld camera for some famous movie, and there we were up in his wonderful apartment way up in the hills, and it was a very dry summer, and Abbott, of course, smoked, and everyone there kept moving him, without him being aware of it, away from the edge so he wouldn't throw a cigarette over the edge and cause a forest fire and burn the house down. I mean, Abbott was totally oblivious to much.
Yeah.
And many.
Did you feel then, you meet the man? We're getting very personal, so you've got to let me know if I get too personal. I don't want to. I'm genuinely curious.
I'll try to answer questions about Abbott, not talk about me.
No, you're talking about both of you, and that's obviously that's the story no one knows. And as much as you want people to know, they will know. As much as you don't want them to know, nobody has to know. But it's fascinating to me that, you know, people who, if two addicts find each other, it's not necessarily easy for either of them to recover. But it seems like you definitely did take it on yourself to be the straight one, the sane one.
Yep, I guess I realized that one of us had to be, if he was going to drag me around the country, then I had to find jobs and make us look right so we could be accepted here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I was the muddled but sane one.
Mm-hmm.
he definitely didn't have a lot of sanity in him.
What was it? Love is its own thing, but was there something that you saw in him where you wanted to see him? I mean, when love will make you want the other person to succeed for sure, but was there something else that
yeah.
you saw in him that was just like, I want to see this come out on a regular basis?
He made me laugh.
Yeah.
He made everyone laugh. If you ever are in a situation where the nicest thing, Jason, about Abbott making people laugh, he never used haughty words.
Mm-hmm.
He never used damn. He never used hell. He never used anything. He made people laugh because he could.
Yeah.
And I guess I just felt like it was worth it. I hadn't laughed for so long, or been happy for so long, or been well or straight or much of anything for so long, that to be with someone who made me laugh, and who in the morning, well, he occasionally made me a heart-shaped meatloaf, you know, that would kind of touch my heart. And then in the mornings, we'd get the paper, and he would reinterpret the political news in a way that would just have me howling on the floor. And I can't do it. I can't repeat it. But that was what he did. He had a political mind. He was so bright. One day, he had driven me right to, this was when we had moved back to Hollowell. He had gotten me to the point where I really and truly felt that I was going to kill him or myself or both of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I went tearing up to the Episcopal Church to find out what I was supposed to do about this, and got put in Al-Anon very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, I went back to him and I said, okay, this is, our marriage is over completely. I'm not going to be here for you if you ever do cocaine again. Well, In a while again, he got into some more cocaine, and I found out I was livid. I was packing. I was going. He said, no, 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 I'll do anything. I said, fine, come to church with me. Well, the man who, as far as I knew, never went to church since the age of 3 in his life, knew everything. I mean, he knew the hymns. He knew the readings. He knew. He was a sponge. He absorbed everything. And sometimes I'd ask him to recall something, and I'd see him stand there, and there was, and he told me once, it was like a recording, and it went around in his head, and when it came to the right place, it went click, and then he had the answer.
Yeah. Wow.
I just, he fascinated me. I couldn't leave, because I'd never met anything that entertained me as much as that, and once I realized that I had been totally brainwashed and became myself again, became well and whole, I felt he needed me so badly I couldn't go.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that's, it's not often you hear, I don't know, I do feel like a lot of stories with folks maybe in his situation is, again, they fall into that trap where they find somebody a little too similar who doesn't have the wherewithal to, again, to do what you did and kind of flip it around and take control. But that's some strength on your part, that because not only dealing with an addict, but dealing with a personality. Comedy people are tough.
Oh, they're awful. I only started really realizing that 3 or 4 years after we were together. People who are comedians are not necessarily happy or well people.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to not be emotionally balanced.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting because there's a generation for which that was just how it is. There's a generation who acknowledged that and kind of tried to live up to that really upsetting standard. And I feel like there's luckily now a generation of comedians who has seen both of those generations and said, oh, I should just try and become a better person but still be funny. So
yeah,
we're lucking out, but obviously you're of the generation where there's a lot of, I'll be frank, there's a lot of shit to deal with.
Oh, yeah. And it was not... See, people then didn't, he was called bipolar,
uh-huh.
You know, there was no real understanding of what people who had these symptoms did. You know, he was just blamed for being a bad boy. When his Aunt Polly tells the story, he lived with his Aunt Polly, and he was about 4 years old, and it was Easter, and she put him in a little white suit and little polished shoes, and she stood him in the middle of the kitchen and said, now I'm going to get dressed, don't you move. When she came back, he was standing in the middle of the floor, he'd gone out in the field, and he'd got a bunch of weeds for wildflowers to give her, and he said Happy Mother's Day to her, and she was incensed. I mean, he grew up with people who had no sense of humor at all.
Wow.
You know, she raised him partially and eternally found fault with his inability to stand still and pay attention. As little boys, we know now, don't just stand still and pay attention.
And it's so interesting, too, that he would be a person who's, you know, so torn, like you said, possibly had ADHD, but, you know, has to play a character who's kind of notorious for keeping one face. He's got this one note where he's got to play. I mean, and while he didn't invent the Kennedy impression, like, he definitely set the standard that everybody stole from, you know.
Well, you know, that's what Rich Little said. Rich Little said, you know, I don't imitate JFK. I imitate Von Meter doing JFK.
How did he have a? I mean, did you? If you know, was there a perception he had once it became okay again to do Kennedy impressions? Because at some point, there's a character on The Simpsons. People are doing them again.
I will tell you, someone at the wharf in Hollowell said, "Would do a JFK," and he said, "The man hasn't said a thing in years." So he didn't accept. Once in a while, on his terms, without being asked or prompted, he would slip into a Kennedy voice.
That's great.
He did a show. As a matter of fact, he wrote a whole show in Hollowell. I don't even remember the name of it now. But it was, he was telling the story of how Camelot came about, and he had actors and he had musicians, and it was a whole staged show. It was very, very nice and well done.
Uh-huh.
But as he, from concept to final show, he could not do it without drinking and drugging a lot, and that really toned down or played down or played havoc with his inspiration,
yeah.
Which he didn't know. He just had to have whatever he thought it took to have this inspiration, and it was so wrong.
Right. Did that all start around the time everybody would assume, or was he before he was performing and before he got famous? Were the drink and the drugs there? I mean, do you have any concept of when it started?
Yeah, well, he drank. He drank. His mother, well, that's another whole story. You know, I hope someday I really can publish Von Meter, Jester of Camelot, because it does. If he dictated this whole book to me,
uh-huh.
And I wrote it down longhand and then typed it out, and it's a... I call it a semi-authorized autobiography because, you know, I interject here and there. But he never drank heavy or hard.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it started when he was in the army in Germany. But he never did drugs. It was when he became famous, the JFK thing really landed on this country boy with, I mean, this Maine boy with no sophistication whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
who all he wanted to do was make music. Suddenly there he was at this little improv place, little bar, and I guess in the village, and out of his mouth came JFK, and pretty soon Dowd and what's his name, who wrote it, appeared, and they loved it, and one of them arranged for him to be on the Arthur Godfrey summer program, fill-in radio program, and he did the JFK thing. And then he had three stints with Ed Sullivan, and once was before the First Family was published. Before it came out. So he had the mind, he had the political sense, he had... I don't know what it was. He just had that talent. I mean, whatever talent we have, if we if we show it to the public, that's mm-hmm. what they accept.
Yeah. My goodness. The more I hear about him, obviously, the more I do get increasingly interested in what kind of creative stuff he was still trying to do, because I feel like some people treat creativity as it's a thing that gets fueled by drugs or fueled by stress, but sometimes it is that attempt to eke yourself out of a funk, eke yourself out of whatever you've buried yourself into, whether it be drugs or depression.
Yeah.
I'm curious, do you think he actually got to use art as an attempt to get out of himself?
I don't know. I think he always enjoyed, he enjoyed drinking. It was like, well, I don't know that he enjoyed drinking so much, but anything that seemed excitement coming up, if someone was coming from away to visit,
uh-huh.
or he was working on a project, and or he was looking for sponsors for a record that he wanted to make, that pushing that button started the drinking.
Yeah, okay.
And then there was always someone available who had hash or pot or LSD or something to keep him fueled and keep him going. And I had no control over that at all. I couldn't have stopped that or anything. And people would he also was a philosopher, and his I Ching wore out to the point where, but not only the covers fell off, but the pages on the front and the back were falling off. So I had that cremated with him and bought him a new one. But people would come to, because he sold pot too, of course. So people would come to buy pot and stay to have their I Ching, throw their I Ching and have him tell them what they should be doing with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things he wanted to do. He wanted to be a teacher philosopher without ever having to study, of course.
Sure, sure. Was he that way? Because I'm getting, here's the thing. I'm going to start making some assumptions that are based on myself. Okay. So, because the things you're telling me, I'm just like, okay, some of this stuff is sounding like way too much of a parallel creatively. I know what it's like to get into a project, get really psyched about it, and then kind of want to let it go to the world and just put it out into the wind, which is a bad instinct.
Yes. And it doesn't actually take wings that quickly. That's the problem. Yep. You know, you have to work at something, and work was not something. Actually, that's where the work song came from, because I insisted that he work a little bit on getting something done. So he wrote this marvelous wood. As a matter of fact, one man asked if he could use it to sing it at his retirement party. I suspect that all of you creative guys have something here in common, a thread that runs through you all.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, we spend so much time trying to figure out what that one is, we get very distracted. But again, this is one of those things where you just want to keep creating. It's an addiction. I mean, don't get me wrong. Being creative is absolutely an addiction if you know how to get stuff made.
That's it. And it's really frustrating if you don't have the tools, I guess. I don't know. I really don't know. I know Abbott had to keep going. He overflowed with ideas, and he wanted them out there. And being in Hollowell was the best thing that ever happened. Hollowell, Maine, when we got there in 84, I think, it was either 82 or 84, I think it was 84, was at a hotbed for local music, good musicians. I don't mean trained musicians, but I mean good, natural musicians, lots and lots of music. And he came in at a time when, you know, there was an echelon of the big boys who, you know, ran the whole music scene. And then he appeared, and he kind of was top dog all of a sudden there.
Yeah.
Not that the big boys kowtowed to him, but they took him in. And he took them in, and it was all just the most wonderful arrangement. At one point, he had, not Doug Dillard, he had John Hartford was at the University of Maine in Orono. So he got John to come to this little 2,700-soul town on the Kennebec River and put on a show with him.
Wow.
He just had friends everywhere.
Right. Which is, that's the way you get stuff made, but I guess it does take that extra effort to know what to do. Do you think he knew what to do with it, or he just didn't know, and that was the frustration, where it's like, I don't know how to get an agent, I don't know how to do this crap, I've got this thing sitting here, they'll come to me.
Well, he had, when he was first family fame, he had an agent,
right.
He had a bookkeeper, he had an insurance, he had about four men on his payroll who did things like buy themselves yachts while they were taking care of his money.
Of course.
Who bought him decided that he needed an investment, so they bought him a filling station in Manhattan, and the street that was on the corner, and the street on both sides was torn up for weeks, so that went to pot. Abbott didn't want to handle money. He wanted to appoint people to handle money. So he appointed these four people who didn't pay his Social Security, who didn't pay his insurance, who did buy yachts, who just didn't take good care of him. I don't think he trusted agents after that.
So even, what it sounds like to me is that there's a good chance that even had, regardless of if Kennedy had been killed or not, he wouldn't have had the money anyway, because people were just not that sucks. That sucks. The idea that he could have had a retirement.
Well, not only that. Yeah, he could have, and I would have really appreciated it.
I bet.
Not only that. After the first family hit, his agent wanted him to do and set up for Abbott to do, and Abbott never understood about saying, no, I'm not going to do that, so he just did these things. Set it up so it sounded like the president was going to a car dealership and negotiating to buy a car from this local dealer, or he was telling Caroline what kind of candy to buy in the grocery store, you know, that kind of commercialism. And that's when if Kennedy hadn't died, I think Abbott would have been squashed anyway.
Yeah.
Because he was being told to and doing things that were so, I don't know, so icky, so government wrong. You know, you don't, well, maybe you do now with this president, but you didn't go out and pretend you were the president buying a used car.
Right. Yeah, no, that's interesting because of course, we're only two presidents away from complete distrust in Washington, you know, at that point. But yeah, that makes a good point. I do forget because it's not been during my lifetime that there was a time when we got to respect the president for better or worse.
Yes, very respectful of the president. And even the first family itself was considered somewhat disrespectful. You probably have heard the John Kennedy doing a presentation. I don't know who he was talking to, whether it was reporters or what, but he said that after the record came out, he said that he thought it sounded more like his brother Teddy.
Yes, I have read that one, yeah. But I've also read that there's a quote that Kennedy said something to the effect of Von Meter couldn't be here tonight, so I showed up instead, that kind of thing.
It went on Steve Allen, and another very ill-advised thing happened. He was supposed to just pick a number out of a phone book and dial it, and it turned out to be in a time zone that was much later than it was where he was dialing. And some little old lady who didn't have a clue what was going on when she was waked up out of her sleep thought she was talking to the President of the United States.
Oh, no.
That was all very confusing and upsetting to everyone. So that didn't go over well. But, you know, Abbott should never have been allowed to be out of his safety frame. When he was at Boston College doing a presentation before a group of college students, he did his shtick. And then he asked, as he often did, for people to ask questions from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And he was wonderful. That's what he did. That's what he was so good at. But then he would be put in a situation where he was supposed to play the president doing something non-political, and that's where it broke every time.
That's interesting, because I feel like in a lot of cases, for somebody who you would typically call maybe just an impressionist, their skill is usually, oh, I'll just put this in any kind of context. But it's interesting to me that he had to have that political context and kind of had to be, is it wrong to say he had to be sort of saying something with it in order for it to work for him?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Pre-planned, preconceived things for him were not good.
Yeah. Wow.
And he was not a comedy writer. That's the thing. He flubbed two or three different times, to my embarrassment, once in Louisville, and I don't know where else we were. But he was just going to write a funny stand-up show. Well, stand-up is not what he did funny. The only thing he did funny was his political stuff and his lyrics. He could write funny lyrics. But put in the wrong situation, it was just... it was so wrong, and that's where it all came apart.
That's so interesting because, you know, it's a time, too, where people, in terms of comedy, I feel like, knew their place. Where it's like, I'm a writer. No, this is what I do. Do not put me out on stage, unless it's Mel Brooks. Mel Brooks is one of those big exceptions who could perform son of a gun, right?
Oh,
So it feels like he definitely had his niche, but either he wasn't listening to his own instincts or other people didn't know where to put him, especially when he catches. I mean, if you catch on fire that quickly... what else are you going to do with it? Everybody, if I were there, I'm going to be honest, if I were there, I'd want to make money off of him. I would have probably turned into a jerk. You know, it's just like, oh, look at this guy. He looks like a dollar sign to me. And so I'm sure that's what happened to everybody.
Absolutely. Well, Renny Santoni, who was an actor in L.A., he played with, who did he play with? Oh, anyway, he was pretty well known. He called, and he was a friend of Abbott's, he called Abbott a one-trick pony.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what it was. And his trick was political humor in his own comfort place, or writing lyrics for his own music. Those were the two things he did, and he did them well. And when people took him out of those, even interviews, I'd been with him on several different interviews, and he pretty much told the same story, and then the interviewer wrote either something tragic or something scathing or something light and frivolous or something just plain boring.
Yeah. To me, it's interesting you could find anything boring in anything he had lived or said, but I mean, I wasn't there, so that's weird to me that that would ever happen.
Well, there was one guy from Louisville who managed.
You know, it's interesting because I don't know when I first heard the story of, at least, you know, it's a good maybe 1/32nd of his life story. But the first family, because I think I knew my mother had had it, of course, because everybody did growing up. And then I remember they released a documentary about him. Now, were you involved in that documentary or have you seen it? I'm curious because I've never actually watched it. I was a little afraid it was.
The first impersonator?
Yes.
Yes, I'm in it.
You're in it. Okay, so good. So is it something that ended up, do you think, doing justice or telling the story in the way it should have been told? I've never seen it.
Abbott was at a point where he was on oxygen constantly.
Yeah.
He was on prednisone, so he was huge, the big moon face, the humble, you know, just he looked awful.
Yeah.
I don't think he'd blown his face up at that point, but maybe he had and it was somewhat healed. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
but it was done in my home. I inherited, when my father and stepmother died, I inherited their place. So we moved back to Maine and we're living there. And these two young men came to and spent days doing this. And they had been to the National Democratic Convention. No, not to the convention, to the impersonators convention.
Oh, okay.
And there are pictures of all, you know, Hillary Clinton's impersonator, and there are two George Bush impersonators. And at some point you hear at the beginning in the background just talking, someone said to either Chad Friedrichs or the other fellow, well, you ought to go talk to Vaughn Meader. So that's how that happened.
Wow.
They got to him.
So even they didn't necessarily have him in mind. It just kind of happened.
No. Yeah, it happened. Someone said you should go talk to Vaughn Meader, and there it was. They did a really thorough, I thought. As thorough as you could. It's like trying to put a pin in a shadow and have it stay there.
Yeah.
You know, you really couldn't pin Abbott down like that.
Right. Well, and that's the interesting thing, too, is because obviously I'm talking to a third party. You're the third party who probably knew him best, but the hard part is, and I think this is always the hard part, too, with anybody you know or care about. It's like, how much do I have them grasped? Obviously, you had him figured out enough to keep him alive. You know, I mean, that's so huge, and to make him happy and to be happy with him. But it's so interesting that you can live a life with somebody, and then somebody else can go make a documentary about him. And I don't know. There's a million people that are going to try and tell his story. I'm trying to do it right now. One hopes, that Tom Hanks gets that movie made.
It never will. It never will.
No?
It went from Alex Flew did the screenplay, and then talked to Playtone a few times, and they sent it over to HBO.
Oh, okay.
HBO had it for a while. Now, this was very interesting because this is one of the things that Abbott actually made money from. Playtone had an agreement that up to $100,000 they would send him.
Uh-huh.
And then as soon as they started filming, there would be more money. And so there was always that hope alive that filming would happen.
Sure.
So HBO also did a workup of the script.
That's interesting.
And that never went anywhere. So somewhere in the back of the back and beyond, there are a couple of scripts and maybe a piece of paper saying this is the Vaughn Meader story, if you ever get around to it.
That's
we'll see.
That's interesting. You know, and okay. Not long after I started this podcast, too, there were rumors that Bill Hader, who's a very funny guy from SNL, wanted to play him and was showing interest in maybe I get the movie made. But I've also heard nothing since then. He'd actually be good. He's too old to play him now. But, you know, because he was, what, 26 or so, 27 when he was doing Kennedy? He's very, very, he's so young. Yeah, that's too young. That's too young.
Oh, yeah. He really wasn't hardly an adult. I mean, if you consider adult at 18, you're kidding yourself. You know,
you're right.
You don't get grown up till you're somewhere in your mid-20s.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky. Or not.
I definitely was not in that camp. I didn't. I'm barely there now, and I'm almost 40.
You sound very young.
I'm almost
40. Are you very young?
I'm 37.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
That's good and young.
Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take it. All I care that happens now is if they make a Von Meter movie that I'm in there somewhere. I'll play some idiot.
Ah,
I don't care.
Well,
you know,
hey.
I'm going to be somewhere on the side. I don't give a crap. I just want to be involved. So, Bill Hader, if you're listening, first of all, Bill Hader, you're older. No, Bill Hader's my age, so yes, we're both too old to play him. But somebody.
Yeah, and you'd have to have a good widow's peak. You know,
oh, right, yeah.
Hair, man. he had gorgeous hair.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when I met him that first night at the inn when I was, you know, having my first martini after 3 weeks of sobriety. I sat down and I looked at this man, and he had the most gorgeous teeth, which I found out later was, you know, the roundhouse, you know, star smile. Cost a fortune, but it sure did look pretty. And he had on this great Charlie One Horse hat. Well, Charlie One Horse designs these Western hats and puts critter parts on them. So there was this man with this gorgeous smile playing and singing in this amazing voice with this hat. And at the end of the song, and I know it was to captivate me. He had me from the moment he took off his hat and he ran his hand through this mass of hair. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm in love. That was it.
Did you?
I mean, how frivolous is that to fall in love because someone takes their hat off?
I don't know. I've heard crazier stories. I've heard much crazier stories. That's pretty cute. I gotta give it. I'll give it to you. That's pretty cute. And it sounds like it's just about anybody. I mean, you just described it, and I'm pretty sure I just fell in love with him. So, you know, that's a pretty good story. Did you know him? Did you know of his work at all? Or did you kind of remember him as a footnote?
I remembered him the way everybody did. You know, you turned on your radio, and there was either, you know, 4 minutes or 30 seconds of him doing something that really tickled you on the radio. No, I knew who Von Meter was. I heard his voice everywhere. But he was there in my town, and I thought, why the heck not? So I didn't call. It's interesting, too, because when I went home with him that night and the next day, I just kept calling him Piano Man. I could not bring myself to call him Vaughn. And I can't tell you why. I still don't know why. I just couldn't call him Vaughn. So about the third time I said Piano Man, he said, call me Abbott. And I said, why? And he said, because my mother's maiden name was Abbott. Her name was Mary Abbott. And my name is Abbott Vaughn Meter. And all my family and all my friends call me Abbott. He said, but when I knew I was going to be, you know, famous, I thought I ought to have a stronger name than Abbott, so I went with Vaughn. I couldn't help but laugh because Vaughn doesn't sound a lot stronger than Abbott, but it goes well with Meter.
It certainly does. You're not wrong. That's so interesting to me. Did you... What... I don't know. This is a hard question to ask, and I don't always like to ask hypotheticals, but was there a concept, and maybe you didn't talk about this, but a concept of what he would have wanted a legacy to be? Because I think he's left one, and I think upon reexamination, it's stronger than people give it credit for, and I do think even his later albums, which, you know, maybe are not his strongest efforts, are at least interesting and at least part of a landscape, and obviously at some point I'd love to hear more of his music, but he's left a legacy, and and people often discard legacies that get marred by something that's out of control of the artist. And I don't think that's fair. Do you know how he wanted to be remembered, or if he just wanted to be remembered? It's hard
to tell. You have to think about how totally unimportant the whole first family, one and two, and the follow-ups and that whole thing, how unimportant it was to him, because he simply walked away and left his whatever, the gold record. He left that. He left his, you know, his incredible. He had a hi-fi system throughout his apartment. He just didn't care about taking any of that with him. I got a call from somewhere on the West Coast saying, you know, I'd like to buy Von Meter's whatever gold record.
Yeah.
And I said, sorry, I've never seen it.
Oh, my God.
You know? So that he didn't care about. If he had a legacy, and I pretty am sure this is what he wanted, the music that he wrote, the things that he did himself.
Yeah.
That's what was important to him, that people would want him to sit down and not do John Kennedy, but want him to do Abbott Meter.
I think we'll talk about this later, but I think there are opportunities for that to happen, because it would be fun for the world to hear the stuff he put together, like you say, on his own terms. That's always kind of, you know, you never want to say somebody's born in the wrong era. Obviously, wasn't born in the wrong era, but in the era of digital, to make your own crap and get it out there, it's not that much effort. You know what I'm saying? Like, it would have been easy for him to put together a song, throw it out there, and forget about it. And who knows,
but
something could happen.
He wouldn't have done it. He would not have done it.
No, still?
That's the thing. He would not have done it. He would have had to find the right person that he could manipulate to do it for him.
Right.
In the same time that everybody was getting drunk and stoned, and then he wouldn't even do an interview to say, yeah, this was my work.
Yeah.
If that was his method of operation.
So it sounds like, at the end of the day, me still talking about him and you being willing to sit down is still other people doing work to restore a legacy that he didn't take the time to work
on. No. He had really very little interest. He felt that it was all going to take care of itself.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't let other people help. That's the thing.
Yeah.
He just knew that it was all going to be there. Nobody had to do anything about it. Don't worry.
That's so fascinating. And again, it's more fascinating because it's just ringing true. And it's just, I feel like you've taught me a million lessons in an hour and 15 minutes. My brain has just been going a mile a minute. And I'm like, oh, right, I kind of do that. Oh,
okay,
right.
Well, as long as you're nice to your wife.
Yep, yep.
And love your cats and your children and, you know, behave yourself socially.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll give myself some credit on that front. I think I'm okay. I mean, we could all get better, but I think I'm okay. But I will tell you, I'm learning some creative lessons here. Do you have some, like, out of all of his work, like, of everything you know of his work, is there one particular thing that for you stands out as, like, this is a really great example of who he was, or what I really loved about him, what made me laugh?
Yes, Love Is the Name of My Song. He did this the first time I heard him do it. We were in Florida, and he had a favorite bar that he played very close to our house. And it is recorded, and it's recorded in Louisville, because he did a big show at Rudyard Kipling, and he did it there. And it was recorded, and that may be the only recording, but Love Is the Name of My Song is truly the thing that makes me so glad that I knew. The First Family doesn't touch me. Any of the, you know, LPs, I know he hated doing them. He wasn't happy. He was not happy in his own skin, in his own life, in his own work, in anything. So I don't like that. I like the things that he's done, and of all of the pieces that he's done that I've heard, I think probably The Night Before Christmas at the White House is probably number one, but I don't know that yet.
Yeah.
Love Is the Name of My Song, and it's a comedy song.
I love that. Is there a recording of that somewhere?
That's the one that got recorded at Rudyard Kipling in Louisville, and I have been trying to get in touch with Hiram Hogg. Hiram Hogg was an attorney. He's since retired. I can't locate him anywhere to find out who the person is who did that recording, so I could have a copy of it.
Right. I'm sorry. You did say that earlier. I apologize. So that's
I'm a little lazy and and don't manage the internet well enough to be able to find people and contact them. So I'll never have it.
Well, I, obviously, I'm pretty persistent with this stuff. I'm gonna do a little bit of research. I'm going to try and help you out because
that would be wonderful.
It would also be helping me out because I'm fascinated. I want to know more.
You would love Love is the Name of My Song. And that and the fact that he made me laugh are the two things I think that kept me sane, sober, and with him.
Yeah.
Well, laugh is a very powerful drug. And
isn't it?
It is. And I will admit to have fallen in love over laughs, lost love over laughs, been fallen in love with over laughs. And then, you know, it's very easy, too, to be like, oh, they love me because I'm funny. Well, I guess we'll be together forever. It's damaging to both sides, you know?
Well, that's it. You know, I have been, when Abbott has performed, especially in places where I'm not known quite as well as, you know, they think they know him because people get the damnedest ideas from watching people on television, in movies, or listening, thinking they know them, which is so absurd. But anyway, he and I would be standing there, and people would want to come up and talk to him, and then there would always be someone in that crowd who would be afraid to approach him.
Right.
So usually it was a woman. So she would come up and just kind of like, you know, slam all over me because I was married to Vaughn Meader and she was afraid to go up and talk to her herself. I have had elbows in the side. Oh. I have had my foot stepped on by people who just get out of my way so I can get to him.
Oh, my
people.
God. Wow.
And it always made me laugh. You know, people are the most amazing things that God ever created.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Here's the thing. I could absolutely talk to you all day. This has been a blast, for lack of a better word. This has been so much fun to talk to you, and I appreciate you being so incredibly just honest and frank with me. There's just so much that you didn't have to tell me that you did that I don't think damages anything. I think it gives us a really good picture of him, and also you're a fascinating person too, so I really like getting to know you better. I mean, you are the other half of the story. You're more than the other half of the story. You know, there's a big part of, you know, his life that people didn't know about because either didn't want him to know, or as we've discussed today, you know, if somebody else would have figured it out for him, you know, somebody else would have told the story, and you've done it.
He has two dead wives, but the other alive one would be a trip to talk to, but you wouldn't learn a lot about Abbott talking to her.
Okay.
So I guess you picked the right wife.
I'm going to ask if you have anything to promote. I'm supposed to ask that at the end of a podcast. What do you want to promote?
Oh, gosh. Well, I would love to promote somebody into finding me the night before Christmas at the White House.
Yes.
And the other side of that, of course, being Santa Claus and JFK having a conversation about running their vast businesses. I would like to promote the idea of actually getting Vaughn Meader, Jester of Camelot, published, because there are very, like Dr. Cull from the University of Birmingham. Famous people's quotes are in it, and Abbott dictated most of it, and it's a quick romp through his life, and I don't know that it's fun, but it's a read, and I'd like to see it read.
Well, I would too. I'd love to read it myself, no pressure, but if there's any way you can send me a copy, I'd absolutely love to read it.
Well, I'll tell you that it's already been used as the base for the first write-up of his life by Alex Wu for Playtone, and it's been used by Entertainment Weekly.
The
very first issue that they had, that wasn't just little bits, little quotes, little dabs, which they were famous for. They decided they would go for a full, big centerfold of somebody, and they chose Abbott.
Wow. That's great.
And he is it. And we were in Gulfport, Florida, which is St. Petersburg, and St. Petersburg has a beautiful museum, and Bob White, Robert White, has a huge and highly questionable collection of JFK memorabilia. So the wall is covered, a museum wall is covered with all the front pages of newspapers from around the world announcing JFK's assassination. And Mary Ellen Mark came and took pictures, and I can't remember why I'm telling you all this now.
It's
anyway, that has nothing to do with me being pushing something, but I did want to tell you that his Entertainment Weekly has a huge spread on him. Oh, yes, and David Isay also did an interview in the New York Sunday Times the night before we left to move to Florida. So that's there. And then David Isay also wrote this by all means, I'm walking to the other room so I can find the name of it. By all means, go get this book called, oh dear, I'm taking up time.
You're fine.
I can't find it. Oh, bother. I knew I should have pulled this out before you called because I knew I wanted you to read it.
If you figure it out later, I can also tag it into the end of this. That would be easy enough to do.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Holding On by David Isay and Harvey Wang. And Dixie, whatever her name is, she has the Hubba Hubba Hall of Fame just off Route 66, and she was a Marilyn Monroe stripper impersonator.
Oh, my
and
God.
And Isay has written a story about her, and in it she says she saw Von Meter in his cashmere coat standing in the rain. This was after JFK had been killed, looking so sad. And then she realized after Marilyn Monroe died, all of her gigs dried up.
Oh, my God, huh?
So she knew. So anyway, I don't know if this answers anything that I was trying to say to you.
Everything you've said has been fascinating and interesting to me. And we've got more to talk about off air, too. But I do very much appreciate you taking the time with me.
Okay.
And thank everyone for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15-plus years.